Time to talk weather and climate with our weather guides, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. You know what? Summer's gone.
Summer's gone.
And fall has arrived, so I'm sure we'll maybe talk a little bit about some of those kinds of changes that are on the way, and certainly we'll be answering your weather and climate questions. I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Steve, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
And John, great to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
You know, when I think about fall, I usually, because I teach, I associate the beginning of fall with, you know, like sort of the end of August, the 1st of September.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not the real start of...
No. We're into it now.
Yeah, we're into it now. How do they figure when summer ends and fall starts? Is there a... is it something that's... a temperature thing over time?
No, it has to do with the inclination of the Earth's axis to the plane of the ecliptic, which is the plane that contains the sun and the Earth. And so at the equinoxes, then the Earth's axis is tilted in a position that has no, it's not tilted towards or away from the sun. So there must be a way to calculate exactly when that occurs in the big ellipse. Well, it's almost a circle, but it's an ellipse around which the Earth rotates around the sun.
Okay, so they can pretty accurately measure.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
But that's kind of like the astronomical definition.
Right.
Right, yeah. So when would you call the meteorological definition?
Oh, for me, it's totally anecdotal, but it would have started today. The first time I can see my breath in the morning when I go out get the newspaper. That's the beginning of fall. And it seems to correspond to about the first time the temperature dips below 45 degrees in the morning.
Yeah.
And so it was the first time for me, anyway, that I had a clear recollection of it occurring was this morning.
So it began today.
Yeah.
The Martin definition of
spring. Yeah, and it's only 6 days after the actual equinox.
Right. So that's pretty close.
Yeah.
That's pretty close.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Todd Madison has a comment or question, so let's go there. Hi, Todd.
Good morning. Good morning, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a question that's been bothering me for quite a while. I've got a fly shop in Cross Plains, Wisconsin, so we watch the weather quite a bit, see how it's going to affect the streams. And over the last couple of years watching it, it seems like the Wisconsin River really affects the way the patterns go. Does Wisconsin River push things south or keep things southward or push patterns northward, or is that just...
I think the Wisconsin River is probably too narrow to have much of an impact on the weather systems. I mean, clearly it would be... an impact on the coastlines of the river or the coast there. But I think in terms of steering weather system and things, probably not.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with Steve. I think there may be instances in which, and they probably would be the kind that really lodge in your memory, because it might be a day in which a surface boundary that has some significance in terms of developing thunderstorms might really pay close attention to the bluffs. As Steve says, I think the topography around the river at certain spots along its length can, one out of every 25 or 30 times have some influence on forming a line. But I bet you overall, if you really kept score carefully, you'd see that it doesn't have very much effect at all.
Yeah, there you go. All right, thanks for calling. John and Dunn, we'll go to you next. Hi, John.
Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
I have a question for the two gentlemen. One is, the question, I guess, is really having to do with forecasting humidity. And, I mean, everybody can tell when it's humid out, but... is there a way when it's not humid to forecast or to look on a website or something to see when it's going to become humid? I mean, it's important for lots of reasons, but particularly like, for instance, if you're going to be painting and you want to have some dry weather,
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that's interesting, that when it's not humid, it seems like nobody really cares.
Yeah, right.
Except for farmers and painters.
Yeah.
Those are probably two professions where you really, having dry weather could be good for harvesting and as well as painting. Mm. But I think any kind of forecast site often gives you not just the temperature, but what the dew point temperatures are going to be.
That's right. And that's the key right there. And especially if you're looking really quickly at a place you might be working, you know, in a far afield from where you live, if you look at the overnight low temperatures, that's a pretty good indication of what the dew point ought to be the next day. Unless the winds are coming, you know, strongly from the south on that next day, then the dew points are likely to even rise during the day. But other than that, if it's clear, calm, and the low temperature gets to 50 degrees overnight, then tomorrow morning the dew point will be 50.
Yeah. But actually, I'm also thinking now that you probably have a better feeling for what relative humidity means than what dew point means.
That's probably right.
And generally, you don't find forecasts for relative humidity. So what you want to do is look at the forecast for the dew point and the air temperature. And if those things are far apart, then that means it's going to be a relatively dry day.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Daniel in Rice Lake, on to you. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. I've collected many weather-related photos this summer by Minong. One is of a towering cloud structure where the top is blowing off in a long tail towards the east. I assume that is an anvil cloud. Is the top being blown off by the jet stream, and how fast are the winds that make the horn of the anvil?
Yeah, I think that you're right. You're talking about a cumulonimbus cloud that's gotten deep enough to really get its top blown off by the strong westerly winds, maybe at the jet stream level, which is about 6 miles above the ground, maybe not quite that high, although on a good summer thunderstorm day, it easily gets that high. And typically in the summertime, those winds will be in the 70 to 90 knot range, maybe even stronger in particular examples. And so they're being blown out pretty fast to the east. And that's exactly what you're seeing, is the out, and it's all ice up there. There's no longer any liquid water. It's all ice because it's cold enough to be frozen. And so there are snowflakes or other various types of ice crystals that are causing that the anvil.
And so this anvil that you saw, is it long or is it short?
Oh, it was very long, tapering out. You say it was ice then up there.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's also this type of cloud called a pileus cloud.
Oh, right.
That you sometimes get right above, you know, above the anvil, there's this blob that looks like cauliflower that we call the overshooting top. And sometimes you'll get a very thin ice cloud that stretches out past that thing as well. But that's generally smaller than the anvil.
Yeah, it stays right about the same on top
same
of
place
the overshooting top. Yeah.
Daniel,
it's very beautiful.
Yeah,
it
you
sure
should,
is.
If you wouldn't mind, upload it to my Facebook page, The Larry Mealer Show.
Oh, that'd be good, we can take a look at it.
See it. Yeah. If you get a chance, upload it to my Facebook page. It's just go to The Larry Mealer Show. And it's just not Larry Mealer is another Facebook page I have, but The Larry Mealer Show is the one for the radio station. Right. So put it
you
up.
You have
on
two
there.
Of them, don't you?
Yeah, I've got two of them.
Friends on both of those.
Should,
and I just
you
like
should have three. The real Larry.
The real Larry.
Which I agree with, by the way.
Oh, so I hope you have time to do that. That'd be great. You can join in too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Here we had a situation in Wisconsin where we got, 13, 14 inches of rain in a very, very short time this last week.
Yeah, central part of the state, right?
Yeah.
So
and then
Portage,
the soil is pretty dry, too.
And the soil is pretty dry, so we've got some horrendous flooding situations right now, I guess, in the Portage area.
Yeah, that's the problem when you get a lot of rain in a dry soil. It doesn't, the soil doesn't soak it up. It just runs off into the rivers
and
causes flooding.
And, I can remember from living in the Caribbean, we'd get sometimes get those kinds of storms. It seems like we're getting more of those storms here now. Or are we?
I don't know.
Think so?
I don't know if that's true or not. I know that this one was related, we think, at a first glance to Hurricane Tropical Storm Kyle, which was way down the southern Gulf of Mexico. The bigger these things are, then the more influence they have in terms of producing weather far afield from themselves, these tropical cyclones. So there may have been some relationship to Kyle, not unlike the one we had in August of 2007, which was a devastating flood here. And then June of 2008, was it when Lake Delton emptied? So those are related types of events. I don't know if they're any more common now than they used to be. I think they're better understood. And so that a person, once you see 10 inches of rainfall in a day and a half, you kind of are already looking for the right places to lay the blame and try and construct a story about why it happened that way. I don't know it's a very good question whether or not they're more common than they used to be.
So is I was in sunny Spain when this all happened, so I kind of missed it.
It never rains in Spain.
Right? At least not on the plane.
Yes.
So is it low-level moisture that they pump up, or was it high-level, or just the whole
It's probably troposphere? from the bottom of the troposphere to about the middle of the troposphere.
Spare, that's fair.
Plumes come up associated with these tropical storms, but more important, well, equally important, they tend to drive the dynamics that produces the air, the rising air that can then work on that moisture and turn it into heavy rain.
Yeah, there you go.
So it's really evolving, but very interesting story.
Yeah. Let's turn to Sue in Lake Mills next. Hi, Sue.
Hello, I'm just turning off the radio. Okay, I am a permanent resident of Illinois, but I'm a native of Wisconsin, and we have a summer place in Lake Mills. And I have noticed for the last several years anyway that the state line between Wisconsin and Illinois seems to be kind of a marking spot where weather changes. You can notice the change.
Does it get better, I assume, as you're going into
Wisconsin and Illinois?
So does it get better as you go from Illinois to Wisconsin? Is that how the market?
Not necessarily. usually, since the patterns come from the north and west, you know, at certain times of year, I notice it. But being a Wisconsin native, we're really conscious of that. And I just have noticed that, you know, it overlaps a little bit, of course. But you can really tell the difference in rain patterns, snow patterns.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to comment on that, but I'm going to let our experts here ponder it for a few minutes, and we'll be back with our two guests, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, right after a look at the news. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. John is the chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And we had a question about the Wisconsin-Illinois border. A listener feels, at least in her impression, is that the weather, there's quite a change right at about that dividing line. Right. Would there be any reason for that?
Well, we were just looking at a map, and we don't think that there is, in terms of geographical and things like that. There's nothing in there like Great Lakes or that could work together that would make a line of separation between the two weathers. But there has been recent events where it seems like Madison missed precipitation and it hit further down to the south or vice versa. And so it may be that way when they're driving up that they encounter this and think, oh, my goodness, this here it is. It happened again.
And I'd be willing to bet, too, along the same lines, that there is somewhere in that area from the southern part of our own state to the northern part of Illinois, a climatological line where the total snowfall for the season goes from something in the 40s to something in the 20s. I wouldn't guess that's probably the strongest region of contrast for annual snowfall just because of the latitude. The further south you go in Illinois, it gets warmer and warmer. I mean, so St. Louis doesn't get anywhere near as much snow as we do, and that's only halfway down the state.
Right.
So we're probably just about at the sensitive spot of that. And so it could appear that way in a climatological sense.
Yeah.
All right.
Good idea.
Well, that was a good question. Thank you. Linda and Marinette, we turn to you next. Hi, Linda.
I have the question of Indian summer. Is there a way to tell meteorologically that we're going to have one or not?
Boy, the Indian summer is a warming event that occurs usually like in late October timeframe.
About a month after the equinox or something.
Yeah. I don't think there's any way to really forecast that other than a couple of days in advance, which is just like doing normal forecasting.
Yeah, people don't do this as much as we probably ought to. This is probably where we can make the bridge between regular day-to-day weather forecasting and use of climate models to tell something about the slightly longer-term future, is to make anomaly forecasts. I think that professionals do. I don't think that it's gotten down to the level of public consumption, but anomaly forecasts, one could say, you know, we got a good feeling that the next week or two is going to be warmer than normal. I can tell you right now that the rest of this week for our state is going to be sunnier than normal.
Yeah. And drier.
And drier. So the days may end up being a little bit warmer than normal. And I'd feel really confident about making that statement right now. And there'll be other situations, maybe a couple of weeks downstream, where one might also be able to make such a statement and then be able to say, hey, I think we got an Indian summer coming here, 15th to 20th of October. So Steve's right. I think that's usually the way that's communicated is the short-term forecast, but it doesn't have to be that way. We could probably go a little bit longer than that and at least paint a picture of what the complexion might be for a week in advance.
I had an email from Pam in Ripon, Wisconsin, who said, if I heard it correctly in an earlier broadcast with you guys, you mentioned that large fields of crops can affect local weather. Do you have any further reference materials on this or related studies that you know of?
Yeah, with that, we were talking about the huge cornfields in the Midwest, and as air moves over them, the corn really pulls out the moisture from the ground and transpires it into the atmosphere. And boy, the paper that I'm thinking of is by Kidder, but it was in that's his name, K-I-D-D-E-R. But it was in one of our professional society journals, which probably wouldn't be very interesting to read unless you're a meteorologist. And I don't remember which one it's in.
Yeah, I don't know that one either. But I do recall the Plainfield tornado in Illinois, which was in either August or July of, I don't know what year, maybe 1989 or 1990, And I might have the year wrong, but I know it's Plainfield, Illinois, and it was an F5 tornado. It was a devastating tornado. And people who did some research on that, and I've seen websites about it, so it might be easier to read, discuss the so-called dew point pooling that occurs immediately downstream of Iowa, which is where you're growing a huge amount of corn. It's just it's an inland sea, effectively. That's what the soil scientists tell me in July and August. And so that might be a really clear example of such a thing.
Yeah. So search on Plainfield tornado.
Plainfield tornado, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Kidder, what, you remember Kidder's first name?
Stan.
Stan?
Yeah,
Stanley Stan Kidder. Kidder,
K-I-T-T-E-R.
K-I-D-D-E-R, sorry. Yeah. Maybe Google Stan Kidder and something might come up as
there.
Well.
Yeah.
Worth a look anyway. Mark in Middleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. I was an English teacher in Japan, in a city called Kanazawa. If you draw a beeline from Tokyo all the way to the West Coast, the phenomenon there that they were really proud of, because I guess it gave them a certain notoriety, they said that it was one of the few places on the globe where you could hear thunder during a snowstorm. Huh. Now, last year, here in Wisconsin, I was shoveling snow, and I heard some thunder, and it made me think, well, you know, that was 10, 12 years ago. Haven't heard it. How rare is that? And, you know, maybe Kanazawa experiences it more than usual, but when I heard it, it kind of set me thinking, and you guys could answer that.
I'll answer by saying not often. Now I'll let John really answer it.
Okay. Well, I'm aware of a colleague at the University of Missouri who was funded by the National Science Foundation to actually try and understand how frequent and under what conditions thunder snow occurs in the central part of the United States. The conclusions, I think he went in hoping that it was, you know, fairly common. One in every three snowstorms would have a significant amount of thunder reports. Turns out it's not quite that common, but it's far from uncommon. I would say that I've lived in New England for a good part of my life, and then I've lived here for a good part of my life. And I've seen thunder snow in both locations, and I'd say maybe it's even a little more common in New England. But it's, I'd say maybe couple of times per winter on average, and that'll probably translate to one winter you'll get three or four such events, and another winter you won't get any.
Okay.
But I'd say that's about the way it's been for me anecdotally over these 16 or so years.
Yeah.
So it's not that uncommon.
With Kanazawa, the way their snowstorms would happen is we would typically get about a half an inch, and then by midday it was gone.
Mm.
So it never really accumulated. And people just never really had to shovel. They just would sort of wait it out.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe that might have something to do with this, you know, this phenomenon that they were kind of proud of, you know, the fact that we get more of that than anywhere else.
Yeah, I sort of hate to burst their slushy bubble, but the fact is it's not that uncommon. They may get it a little more frequently where there's a little bit of residual snow, and the fact that it's slushy makes me think that since they're slightly warmer, they might have just a little bit more juice for their thunderstorms that come along. And then they may actually get it more frequently than we do, but it's not in a different category is my guess.
So I'm going to argue with John and say that 2 to 3 times is not common. I mean that's pretty rare. And I'm thinking per winter, yeah. I mean, if you had only 3 winter storms a year, wouldn't that be annoyingly few?
Well, yeah, it would. I mean, I am frustrated by that fact, but it's my reality.
Right.
So there's not much I can do about it. You know, we get 15 snow events per year on average that are an inch or more, and you know, maybe one or two of them.
Oh, okay, so about a fifth of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Or maybe even less.
I would have thought we would have gotten more snowfalls than 15.
Not that qualify over an inch or two.
Yeah.
We get a lot of piddly ones.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
And Matthew in Summit Lake, your turn. Hi.
How is everybody today? Good day, gentlemen.
Good. How are you?
I'm very good. I have a question regarding hoarfrost in the winter. Topic of conversation that comes up when we're ice fishing. And I was wondering, because it's beautiful along the lakes.
Yes, yeah. It is.
And I was wondering, is that caused by the water or in the air hitting a dew point below freezing?
Yes. Yep. And it condenses onto some particle that's resting on the window or on the ice. And then once it starts to grow, or in the plants, right, and just grows right off.
Okay. So it is the dew point then, basically.
Yep.
The dew point is below freezing, and so we call it the frost point instead of the dew point because frost forms instead of dew.
Yeah, and it goes right from vapor to solid, right?
Right,
it deposits onto the growing strands.
Yeah.
So there's not even an intervening water, a liquid water stage, which makes it even more interesting.
That's very interesting.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And let's see, we have Sandra in Madison who wonders, how dry was this summer? Are we below average for the past month? When will the first frost occur, and what kind of winter can we expect?
Whew, that's a lot of questions.
Ooh, that's good. But we're not below normal anymore, after this last storm.
No, and we're certainly not below normal for precipitation this summer. This was a very wet summer. So September was a bit of a dry out compared to the summer, but I don't think that it's even below normal for the month of September.
Yeah, when I last checked, the most of the state was well above normal in terms of precipitation for September.
As you point out, the central part of the state is way above normal. Yeah.
And Sandra's in Madison wondering when the first frost will occur. I suppose she means in this area.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I've seen spotted ones this morning over at my neighbor's house, little spots. So it's really going to be depending right now on where you're located and how low the field is and how open it is. But we haven't had a major big frost.
Yeah, widespread frost. We might have a widespread frost Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday.
Oh, okay.
So it's coming this week. If you haven't seen your little spot yet, you probably will see it someday this week. And I would bet with a higher chance of winning the bet that it'd be late in the week, early weekend.
So get your plants in or cover them.
Yeah, I think so. For the weekend, you certainly should.
And what kind of winter can we expect so from what you guys have been able to look at?
NOAA is forecasting for a below temperature for winter time because La Nina is building up.
Yeah,
and that usually means, it's a pretty strong one. So they're talking for temperature-wise below normal, which would be nice. But with regard to precipitation, again, it's the flip of a coin in terms of above, below, or normal conditions.
And I think it should be pointed out, too, that Steve's referencing the tropical Pacific Ocean when talking about La Nina versus El Nino. The El Nino, when it's warm in the tropical equatorial Pacific, that tends to be more strongly correlated with a warm, wet winter for us. And then when it's colder than normal in a La Nina, it's a bit of a mixed bag. So I think the confidence in the forecast is probably lower than it would be if it were.
She didn't ask
really
for the
high.
Confidence in it. She just asked for the. If she wanted the confidence, I wouldn't give one.
No, that's a good forecast. We want to give her a baker's dozen answers.
Right.
Here, I thought you were going to say that she should get the farmer's almanac.
No, Don't waste your money. Buy the Red Sox press guide, which is almost an equal waste of money, but not quite as big a waste of money.
Oh, man. Amanda in Galena, Illinois, let's go to you. Hi, Amanda.
Hey, good afternoon, Larry. Thank you again for all your programs that are very informative. My question is that I don't know where I heard that a scientist that I think was the one who coined the word global warming recently said that we have already crossed the point of no return. I would like to see if your meteorologists know about that and how do we know.
All right. Thanks, Armando.
I guess I don't know what the point of no return means. I suspect there's no such thing in the climate system, whether it's naturally or human-induced changes. The climate goes back and forth. But we may well have put ourselves in a situation where it's going to take a lot longer to pull ourselves out of it than it took to get us in. I think if that's the definition of the point of no return, I think I would tend to agree.
Yeah, because that's a good point. Because once you put things like carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, you burn it and it gets in there really quickly, then it takes 100 years to come out. So it takes a longer time.
Yeah, so we're past that point,
Yeah,
unfortunately. But that doesn't mean you can't start mitigating right now. We can, you know, change the way we do some of our business, hopefully, in the coming years. And that gradually, of course, makes the right kind of contribution to reducing the problem. Yeah. But we will see the effects of what we've already done to the atmosphere carry on for another 50 to 75 years without regard for what we do tomorrow to change and clean our act up. It'll still take that long.
Well, there you go. Thank you for calling. Don in Warren, Illinois. Hello to you.
Hi. In defense of the lady's opinion about the state line, several years ago, like 5-6 years ago, National Geographic had a main topic and the cover was on tornadoes. And in there, they had a fold-out map of the continental United States from 1950 to 2000 with all F1 to F5 color-coded. And if you pull that map out of your library and that book and look at it, you will find that on the state line, I live in Joe Davis County, and that's against Iowa and against the corner in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And in that period, there is this 3 small tornadoes hit in that area, and the whole rest of the area is just blanketed with all these tornadoes.
Mm. Huh. So you mean the state line has fewer tornadoes around that state line area?
Exactly. You have to get that map out.
Yeah.
Joe Davis County is really hilly, though. It's very hilly. That can be a factor. That can be a factor.
Yeah.
And she was talking about...
So is Grant.
Yeah, Grant County is as well. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. That can have some effect on the likelihood that a severe thunderstorm might spawn a tornado or last long enough to spawn a tornado. Mm-hmm. So that is true to some extent. But we thought she was referring to just south of Lake Mills, so sort of to the east of Beloit.
So
our comments were about that. But you're right. I think there's some topography in that far western part, northwestern part of Illinois that's probably not insignificant.
Yeah, you're right. Thanks, Don. Appreciate
to get
your
that
call.
Map.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Well, that's, again, National Geographic.
Does great maps.
Wonderful maps. Yeah. Absolutely wonderful. Cheryl and Fairchild, we'll go to you next. Hi, Cheryl. Thank you for calling.
Hi. The thunder, snow, and frost questions kind of combined. Many years ago, someone had said that you could expect frost 6 months after you heard the first thunder. And that particular year, they had mentioned it because we heard thunder in February during a snowstorm. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if that was true and if it's pretty reliable.
I wouldn't say it's reliable.
Yeah, neither would I.
Yeah.
I'd say it's a shot in the dark that's headed in the right direction.
Yeah.
Because it testifies to two things. The relative rarity of thunder in the wintertime, although, as we've already discussed, it doesn't never happen. We had a really big, the loudest wintertime thunder clap I've ever heard was January 26th of 1996, right outside my front door. And there's no way I was going to expect a frost on July 26th as a result of that. So you see what I mean? I think that in the middle of the winter, it testifies to the lack of thunder. And then if you hear it in March or April, that's probably about right. Sometime in September or October, you'll get a frost. So it turns out to be, on average, reasonable, but it's not reliable.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that.
No, so that's how I think about it.
That's an interesting way to define, some way to define the beginning of spring is a frequency of thunderstorms or
a
number of thunderstorms
is.
Relative to something else.
Yeah.
I always wonder, what could we do to define spring meteorological?
Maybe that is one. And that might be dependent on where you are in the country.
Yeah, right.
But here it would work.
Yeah, it wouldn't work in California, probably.
Yeah. Right.
Works here, though. Thanks, Cheryl. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Open lines will get you on pretty quick. Jeff in Pleasant Prairie emailed in. I remember a few very cold winters after Mount Pinatubo erupted. I understand it was because of the fine particles that it sent into the upper atmosphere. Will the Icelandic volcano that erupted this year have a similar effect?
No. And the reason why, is, as he points out with regard to Pinatubo, is that it was so in a violent eruption that went up into the stratosphere. I mean, once you get in the stratosphere, the particles can stay there for 2-3 years. The Icelandic volcano, which I'm not even going to try and pronounce, really stayed in the troposphere. And that's why it was such a problem to aircraft, because that's where most of the aircraft come. And the troposphere recycles, what, every 6 days or so?
I mean, every nine for water.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Probably for those particles, too.
Yeah. So it's most of the effects of that are already gone, already washed out by precipitation and just settling.
All right. And we'll go to Dennis in Toma next, then. Dennis, hi.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I have a question with regards to the jet stream.
Okay.
And it seems to me that, or at least I heard, that the jet stream has moved a little bit further south than where it has been in the past. And could that be a possibility of why we're getting these heavy rainstorms? And in addition to that, it seems that when we get these high volume of rain, that is coming out of the northwest rather than the southwest.
I think there's not been a really clear signal in the position of the jet as it's evolved, let's say, over the last 30 years. It's a very interesting question. It's one that's well worthy of further study. We're trying to understand a whole bunch of different things in my research lab about the behavior of the jet right now over the Pacific Ocean, so not particularly relevant to the rain events that we get here in the central part of the continent. But I think it's probably not accurate to say that the heavy rain that we just saw last week and then other similarly heavy rains that seem to have a connection to tropical cyclones well to the south emanate from northwesterly type flows. I think the predominant moisture transport flow for those events is from the southwest. Though they may interact with weather disturbances that kind of trickle in from Prairie Canada and then sort of process the water vapor that's arrived in the southwesterly flow. But if you looked at a series of weather maps, you'd probably, especially in middle and upper troposphere, you'd probably say, yeah, that's a southwesterly flow event. And I think this one over the last week certainly was as well.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling. Charles in Fort Atkinson, hello to you.
Hi. I would like to verify the lady's remarks about change in weather crossing the state line. I commuted to Rockford work during the week, and Friday nights I'd drive back to Madison when I lived at the time I was working down there. And more often than not, I noticed the windshield would fog up just about the state line coming home in the evening, in the fall particularly.
So that means it's colder outside across the state line? Probably. That might be consistent with this idea that we were throwing around earlier with regard to snowfall totals over the year. It might just be at a sensitive spot latitude-wise where it's just a little bit colder consistently in the southern part of our state as opposed to the northern part of Illinois. And you might, on certain days, really see that manifest itself. It's just a guess.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Bernard in Milwaukee, hello.
Yeah, hello. I have a question about the ozone layer. Some years ago, there was some emphasis about the ozone layer being a predominant factor in the climate issues. Is that still a factor?
It's a factor in climate issues, but not to be confused with global warming issues. Mm-hmm. So it is something that has been changing with regard to the climate of the Antarctic region, and that has led to a decreased amount of ozone. Particularly during our summertime.
Right about now.
That's right. Yeah, it really picks up the loss. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, and I think the climate issue, as Steve says, is very regional. It's not related to the global climate change issue, and it never has been. It's been more related to a public, a human health issue in the northern and parts of the southern hemisphere.
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you very much. And guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
The time flew by. They will be back again the last Monday of October. Oh, my goodness. Wow. This year is going by. By the way, I want to mention that Michelle Norris, who hosts NPR's All Things Considered, makes a special appearance at the 2010 Wisconsin Book Festival on September 29th at 7:30 p.m. Admission to this special event at the Overture Center is free. Find out more by calling 1-800-747-7444. 1-800-747-7444. And I see we have only 137 more pledges to go to reach 800 donations, which means we can take a day off the pledge drive.
Yeah,
so if you haven't pledged, Do it now. Go to WPR.org. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.